This Civic Media podcast is sponsored by UW Organ and Tissue Donation. Organ donations are desperately needed, and now is the right time to become an organ donor. Talk to your family. Get the dot. Save lives. Go to heroicdeed.com.
Thanks for listening to Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money, a joint production of Civic Media and the Patriotic Millionaires. For more information, go to patrioticmillionaires.org. And be sure to tell your friends. The Patriotic Millionaires buy advertising across a number of Civic Media stations.
What's up, y'all? It is the 3 o'clock hour, and so it's time for Maggie and the Millionaires Talk Money. My special guest today is Wendy Lee, a sociologist and fellow at the Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University. Wendy studies the careers and social networks of public policy professionals, the people who write our laws, and is writing a book about the revolving door between government and lobbyists. Welcome, Wendy. You're also a University of Wisconsin-Madison graduate, so hello to my fellow Badger.
Yes. Hi. Thanks for having me. I am a proud Badger, and I'm really excited to be here today.
So I wanted to get in, how does somebody become a lobbyist? Where do these people come from? Frankly, there's a lot of lawyers who are lobbyists. Where does this whole industry emanate from a pure, who are the lobbyists? What do they do all day? What does it look like?
Yeah, this is a great question. So I guess I'll just start by saying there's a lot of diversity and variation in what we mean when we've been saying that someone is a lobbyist, right? What I think most people have in their mind when they think about a lobbyist is maybe a guy in a suit with a briefcase knocking on doors in the halls of Congress, or maybe, sitting in a smoky back room somewhere at a bar and trying to, do deals with policymakers.
The old cigar clouded back room. Yes,
exactly. But what I find is that actually the vast majority of lobbyists do their work out in the open, and their work is being reported on. They're being, covered in newspapers. It's a pretty mundane job, actually, when you get down to it. A lot of people work for lobbying firms, which act like law firms. So people, go to them, say, I need your services. I'll sign a contract. I'm going to be your client. But then a lot of them also represent organizations directly. So a company like Microsoft or Pfizer, for example, has a lobbying office, a government relations office in D.C., that has a staff, and they're sort of permanently, based in D.C. You also have organizations that aren't necessarily companies, right? So a labor union, like the one I was a member of at Wisconsin, the American Federation of Teachers, has their own lobbyists, or a professional association, like the American Medical Association that represents doctors. So there's a lot of variation in, who lobbyists are representing and what kind of work they do. And then
I was just going to say, to just recap so that people are catching this, you've got lobbyists that work for individual corporations. You've got trade lobbyists. You have lobbyists working for innocuous sounding groups whose purposes are somewhat vague and undefined until you dig in. Am I getting the categories mostly right? And please keep adding to them.
Yeah. And this is a constantly changing landscape. So this is also some of the trouble, but also, I think what makes this research so so exciting. And so, yeah, you do have groups that are very, forthcoming and say, I'm advocating for oil companies, or I'm advocating for real estate, brokers, right? But then you also have what we might call deep lobbying or shadow lobbying groups. And these are groups with really nice names like the Center for Progress or, Americans for, Innovation and Jobs or whatever. I think I made that one up. I don't know if that's real.
They make them up, so that's totally fine.
But, and then when you dig into it, you start seeing, they have specific corporate sponsors, or, maybe the staff is all coming from one law firm and they all have a very specific point of view. And so you do get those kinds of instances too of, you know, influence maybe being laundered in some way. But for the most part, I find that most lobbyists are actually pretty forthcoming of who they're representing and what perspective they're coming from.
So are lobbyists the vehicle through which money enters politics, or is, are they just one of many ways that money influences politics?
Yeah, I would say it's one of many. So I think especially right now with the election, a lot of people are talking about campaign finance. I know my texts are blowing up asking for donations. And then you hear about super PACs and corporate PACs and the, you know, whether or not, you know, people who are going to fundraisers have influence. And I would say that is a thing that can get you a foot in the door, but it doesn't get you to the point of actually changing what the content of policies and laws look like. In order for that to happen, you need to hire lobbyists. And that's where lobbying expenditures come in. These groups, you know, they spend millions of dollars a year hiring people who are very well paid to physically be in Washington, D.C., to be, you know, taking meetings with policymakers, but also to be doing a lot of legal research, economic research, technical research to back up what they're saying, right? They can't just go to a policymaker and say, this is good for my company, it'll make us money, so you should do it. They have to go and say, you know, this is what you care about as a policymaker. I hear you. I care about that too. Our company agrees with you. And this is how I think, you know, as a company, you can achieve that. And what they're saying is, of course, good for the bottom line of their company. So it has to be backed up by that sort of, you know, technical and legal, like, legitimacy.
Yeah. And in a very layperson frame, the way that I have described lobbyists are the best communicators on the planet, backed up by basically outcome determined research that they may be doing themselves because they want to advance a position that is beneficial to their company, interest group, trade, industry, etc. Is lobbying bad? Like, is all lobbying bad, or is there good lobbying? How does it work?
Yeah, I mean, no, lobbying is not bad. And it's a constitutionally protected right. You know, the First Amendment says we have the right to free assembly, and that includes expressing our views, whether you're a person or a regular person or a business person, or a corporate, you know, you're sitting on the corporate boards of directors for a company, you have that constitutional right. And so I don't think we should necessarily see lobbying as something that needs to be eliminated or cracked down on. But I do think the balance of lobbying right now is pretty skewed, and the resources that people have for lobbying are pretty skewed in one direction, and that's definitely towards businesses. You know, like I said, there are a lot of organizations that do lobbying that are have a lot of interest, right? Professional associations, labor unions, social movement organizations, groups that advocate for public interests, they're all doing lobbying too. But, you know, their spending and their, you know, their workforce is a drop in the bucket compared to what corporate lobbyists are doing. And I don't have, you know, recent data, but there are political scientists who have been tracking lobbying spending. And back in 2012, for every $1 that labor unions spent on lobbying, businesses spent at least $56.
I'm sorry, that was 56 to one?
Yes. And that's what we can track, right? So there's a lot of money that is not being reported. And we can assume that that number has not only gotten a lot bigger in the last 10 years, but is also just not, you know, is not the whole universe of what they're spending money on.
And I'll just, because I hear a lot of this pseudo false equivalency between, frankly, organizations that lobby on behalf of working Americans in the middle class and unions and other corporate spending. But the reality is that on a scale basis, they're simply not even in the same league. And this is my opinion. not Wendy's, everybody that's listening, you folks out there. But since 2012, which is the most recent stats that Wendy's citing, again, corporate lobbying dollars, 56 to every one union dollar. My opinion is that likely since 2012, because of the weakening of unions through various legislation across the country, it is highly likely that those numbers have become even more skewed in favor of large corporate interests and away from organized labor, simply because there is less organized labor than there was in 2012. Wendy, is lobbying regulated? And if so, how? And is that the right regulation? Is it enough regulation?
Yeah, it is regulated. There is a law called the Lobbying Disclosure Act that basically defines what a lobbyist is and who has to report their lobbying activity. There are a lot of problems with this law. There's a lot of loopholes. For one, it mostly focuses on Congress. And so there's a term in this law called covered official. Mm. And the definition of a covered official is basically anyone who works in Congress. So a member who's elected, but also their staff. And then also senior level political appointees in the executive branch. But what that doesn't cover are the hundreds of thousands of federal agency employees who are not appointed. These are people who are sitting in these agencies for decades, right? They're career civil servants, and they're writing the regulations specifically that we as society live under. And so when lobbyists are talking to these people who are holding the pens, they don't have to report that. And there's also a rule in this law that you don't have to report if you do less than 20% of your work as lobbying. And so a lot of people will say, oh, I'm not lobbying. I'm doing policy research, or I'm doing general public education. And there's very little enforcement and, auditing in terms of like going into someone's calendar and saying, okay, are you actually doing 20%? There was a study by another political sociologist who found that about half of the lobbyists who register are not reporting, or there's about twice as much actual revolving door lobbying happening than
reported. Yeah.
So, yeah, as part of this law, you also have to report if you previously worked in government. And a lot of people aren't doing that either.
Folks, that is Wendy Lee. She is a sociologist and fellow at SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University. She writes and studies about public policymakers, the revolving door, lobbying, all this good stuff. We're going to have to take care of a little bit of business here. But what is the revolving door, very briefly, Wendy? Because that's what I want to talk to you more about after these very quick messages. But what's the revolving door?
Yeah, so it's basically when people move between government and lobbying throughout their career.
Ah, yes, the old from government into the private sector and lobbying, and then back into government potentially, and mm-hmm. then back once again, hence the revolving door. Now that we know what it is, Wendy, everybody talks about it like this is a really bad thing. We'll explore whether or not the revolving door is itself the problem, or whether it's the influence that can get wielded in the private sector as a lobbyist because of our porous campaign finance laws and porous regulation of lobbying itself. All of that and more coming up next with sociologist Wendy Lee on today's episode of Maggie and the Millionaires Talk Money here on the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Oh. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. My special guest this half hour is Wendy Lee, a sociologist and fellow at the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University. We're talking about lobbyists and the revolving door. Cardi, I'm going to ask you to make sure that my face is up on the Facebook. Thank you so much. Got my new producer, new part of the Maggie Dawn team. There we are. Love to see you, Wendy, and to see all you folks watching on Civic Media's YouTube channel. Wendy, we left off talking about the revolving door. Is it the revolving door itself that is the problem, or is it the regulatory structure around dark money, soft money, and lobbying?
Yeah, so I would say for the most part, the revolving door itself is not a problem. You know, just think about your career or, you know, people's careers that you care about. You want people to be able to move around, right? That is a sign of a healthy labor market. It's a sign of a healthy career. And I don't think we should necessarily be telling people you can or can't work in a certain place, right? But I do think the problem is that because corporations have so much money, have so many resources, they're able to hire more former government staffers than, you know, an organization that is relying on public money or nonprofits, you know, would be able to have, right? And so we have to think about sort of the bigger distribution of where lobbyists, revolving door lobbyists are going and coming from. And that's where the problem starts to happen. You start getting into these cycles of, you know, if one person leaves the government office, their colleagues might say, oh, that person is making a lot more money now. Also, they were able to do it. I should talk to them and figure out how, you know, maybe they can help me get a job in the private sector. And so it becomes kind of like this cascading effect as well.
Yeah, I think of one example that I think many of our listeners, many of you folks out there may have heard about. That was back during the escalation of the opioid crisis. There was an absolutely critical regulator at the FDA and in some of that also worked in some of the other regulatory enforcement agencies. And literally the lobby bought him. He left the regulatory environment, left the federal government, made millions of dollars, and then testified against better regulatory enforcement of opioid manufacturers and distributors. It is the most clear example of this sort of perversion. When we think about this and we think about what we should be asking our elected officials and greater disclosure, whatever it is, what are some of the top reforms that come to mind when you discuss this with people and based on your own research, Wendy?
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of people are saying we need to crack down on the revolving door. And there have been a few proposals for that. I feel like every election cycle, someone brings it up. Obama tried to put in revolving door regulations. Biden tried to put in revolving door regulations. I don't think Trump even cared about it. But what happens is they start realizing that it's almost impossible to, you know, first of all, tell people not to take a certain job, but then also, you know, figure out who to hire when you're putting limitations on, you know, where people have worked and what, you know, what companies they've represented. You know, for example, there are a lot of hiring bans. So, you know, people will say, okay, we're going to put a ban on hiring people who were registered lobbyists, or they'll instate a cooling off period. So, you know, people who are leaving government aren't allowed to lobby on anything they've worked on for the past 1 or 2 years, depending on, you know, what people are saying the cooling off period is. And I think that those are common sense, but what actually happens because, you know, lobbying is not really well regulated is that it only just drives demand for revolving door lobbyists who can sort of find other informal ways of lobbying that don't have to, you know, sort of meet the definition of what a registered lobbyist does. So in some ways, I think if we start kind of cracking down on that, it might actually create these perverse incentives to, you know, hire more revolving door lobbyists. There's another way of thinking about this too, which is, okay, so if the revolving door right now is skewed towards business, then maybe what that means is we need to balance it out by hiring from, you know, other kinds of organizations, right? And I think you do see this happening. There's some recognition that we need to diversify the federal workforce. The Biden administration, I think, you know, famously appointed Lina Khan as the
head of the FTC.
Whereas, you know, I think the traditional background for someone in that position is typically someone who's had much more close ties with business. Maybe they've represented businesses at a law firm or have even lobbied on their behalf. And so, you know, there is that recognition that, oh, we can also hire from people who have worked in labor unions or have worked as organizers or have worked in academia or other places that aren't necessarily so close to business. And that's also one way of thinking about how to sort of diversify the networks that people have, you know, the people who are sitting in these government positions.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me because I worked in government. I've worked in the private sector. I now do media. I'm sort of, you know, the Venn diagram of this stuff, isn't it? I'm overlapping in a bunch of them. I knew that when I could feel it when I got into government, and I was a low level governmental employee for the vast majority of my career. But when I got into government, I thought, wow, I've got a really interesting perspective. I bring this diverse experience because I worked at the top level of my profession in the private sector. It was incredibly valuable. So this isn't this like it's either good or bad. It's trying to figure out how to make sure that the diversity of viewpoints and arguments and frankly research and technical thinking about ideas is being brought forth to elected officials and those within the executive branch of government that are responsible for drafting and implementing and enforcing our regulatory environment as well. Is that an oversimplification, or is this really about sort of a D, all of the above kind of approach, Mia?
No, I mean, Wendy, I think you put it perfectly. I might actually take what you said and slap it onto one of my abstracts.
Call me later, fellow Badger. We can talk about it.
Yeah, maybe I'll cite you. But no, I mean, I think you're right. You know, it is about sort of creating the right balance and the right ecosystem. A lot of my research is specifically focused on trade negotiators, and I collected all this data about where they've worked after they left government. And for the most part, when you look at this network, right, like I have all these really complex graphs, they're only really hearing their former colleagues.
I got to jump in. I'm so sorry, Wendy. That's Wendy Lee, sociologist, my guest on this episode of Maggie and the Millionaires Talk Money. Will you come back after the election? We can do a whole show on this, Wendy. I'd love it.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Definitely.
She's coming back. Keep it locked.
You're an organ donor, right? Well, here's a tragic fact. Approximately 20 people die each day waiting for precious donated organs. You could make a life-saving decision simply by getting that important dot on your driver's license. That little dot shows those who need to know that you've made a decision to donate organs at a critical time. Go to heroicdeed.com to learn more about the importance of organ donation and how you can make your wishes known. Talk to your family. Get the dot. Save lives. HeroicDeed.com.
Welcome back, y'all. My name's Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. It is Thursday, and so I got one of my most favorite women in politics, if not my most favorite woman in politics, Dr. Kristen Lierley, candidate for the 8th Congressional District. She is a busy lady these very few days out from the election. Welcome back, Dr. Kristen. How you doing?
So good. Honestly, Maggie, I am having a blast.
I love it. You always bring the high energy. I think that's so important. There's so much going on. I loved your tweet earlier today. First of all, what's your handle on the twit on the X so people can follow you in the run-up to the election?
Kristen for WI. It's KristinForWI.
So check her out. Share with everybody, because the tweet was really important, and I appreciated the conversation that you were having with one of your constituents.
Yeah, well, I've had a couple big tweets lately, but the conversation that I had yesterday was in just north of Green Bay in Suamico. Incidentally, across the street from where some of our Democrat yard signs had been grossly vandalized.
Oh, my goodness.
People spray painting Trump and obscenities and Hitler and just terrible things. Well, you know, of course, all the Republican signs within viewing distance were all totally intact. And I'm having a conversation with a woman at the doors who thinks she's independent. And we bonded over being boy moms. She had three boys. I have four. So I thought, this is good. You know, she's going to, we've got a connection here. And I said, so what is your issue? What is the thing that you're thinking about with this election season? And she said, well, you know, it's abortion. And she's looking at my literature. She knows I'm an OBGYN doctor. It clearly says that I feel that people should have the right to make their own decisions. And I said, what are you thinking about abortion? And she said, well, it's not a federal issue. I mean, it belongs in the states. And I said, you know where I think it belongs? I think it belongs with each one of us as individuals. Mm. You know, you've had three kids. You've got a whole bunch of grandkids. If anybody understands that pregnancy can be hard, not joyful, often very complicated, you understand that. Yeah, you're right. We all need to be able to make our own decisions. We all need that freedom. And it was amazing to see how quickly she flipped on that. And it was clear to me she had just been repeating a mantra that had been taught to her about it being in the states. And she hadn't really thought about what that meant. And that gives me hope, because if we can just have these conversations about the things that we actually care about, I truly don't believe we are as divided as we think we are. But it's that division and that fear that keeps us from having these conversations. And when we can't have the conversations, we can't solve the problems.
Yeah, it's those moments are really inspiring, because again, when we strip back the talking points around stuff and you get down to the brass tacks, the vast majority of Wisconsinites agree on the key issues: money out of politics, right? Healthcare more affordable, childcare more affordable, pro newborn tax credit, pro earned income tax credit, pro child tax credit, like all of these, support our family owned farms, support making these decisions within families. And yet it's gotten so perverted. I've got some sound from Green Bay yesterday, the former MAGA president addressing the Green Bay audience there. There's two bits of sound I'd like to share with you, Dr. Kristen. The first is Donald Trump addressing women. And it was curious, to say the very least. And since you're running in that very district, I would love to get your sense of this language. Cardi, give me a thumbs up when you're ready to roll with it. Because it stood to me in sharp contrast with the messaging that I've, and the values that I've heard expressed by you and Vice President Harris, which is, I trust women. I trust women and their doctors to make these kinds of decisions. And if we don't have that right away, guys, why don't we take a listen to Donald Trump addressing the Green Bay audience? Because it seems that he's got a bit of a penchant for insulting the very audiences he's listening or he's talking to. Let's take a quick listen.
Again, I want to thank Brett for being here.
Turn
and
it up.
Giving me that really incredible tribute of an endorsement. I'm not going to ask him to come up. He made such a good speech. I watched it. Brett made such a good speech. I don't know if he could do that again. Brett, you did so good. I'd let you do it again, but I think you hit it perfectly. What do you think? We love you, Brett. Thank you. We love this guy. Man, he's something. Oh, that arm. Boom, boom. What a player. What a great guy. I think he's beyond as a person. I think he might even beyond what he was as a player, but that's pretty hard to do. Thank you very much, Brett. Great honor to your family. Thank you. We're also joined by Brett's incredible wife, Deanna. And, oh, and that son is so good. He's a great soccer player.
He's a grandson.
Taylor, thank you very much. And look at him. He's a little shy.
Guys, I was actually looking for the sound where he insults Green Bay. Let me just summarize what he said. He kept going on and on like this for a while. And at the end, he says, "I've been here 4 or 5 times. Not sure why I bothered coming back. Maybe because of Brett. I'm not sure why I'm wasting my time with you, all of you people here. Who does this? It's so strange, Kristen."
He does this. He does this all the time. The rambling with the insults and the weirdness, and then people start leaving, and then he gets into a garbage truck. I mean, it's like... It's
after almost missing the door handle a couple of times. Yikes.
Yeah, and like, you know, having some sort of weird walking thing, and it's got to be sensational. And he is so good. If there is one thing Donald Trump is genius at, it's creating that moment that makes people watch and then buy something. And often it's something that is truly junk. But he, for some reason, can get people to do that. But, you know, when you start actually talking to people about it, they understand it, but they don't necessarily recognize why they support it.
Yeah.
And when you can strip away all of that stuff and you come back to the issues, you know, like you said earlier, Maggie, we're aligned on all of these issues. I would also add to the very long list that you shared, clean air and clean water.
Thank you. Forgot that huge one.
Well, it's huge in my district because up in Marinette, we're the third largest contaminated PFAS site. And you know what's happening down in Madison. They're sitting on all of that,
money
for PFAS relief. So like, we need a government that works on the state level. We need a government that works on the federal level. We need a president who actually talks about the issues that we care about that are affecting us, not about in a garbage truck or how big Brett Favre's sausage fingers are. Nobody cares about that stuff.
It's just so, why? All right, we have the sound about women. Let's take a listen.
And my people told me about 4 weeks ago, I was saying, no, I want to protect the people. I want to protect the women of our country. I want to protect the women. Sir, please don't say that. Why? They said, we think it's very inappropriate for you to say, so why? I'm president. I want to protect the women of our country. They said. They said, sir, I just think it's inappropriate for you to say, pay these guys a lot of money. Can you believe it? I said, well, I'm going to do it whether the women like it or not. I'm going to protect them.
Hey.
Or not.
Like, not, Donald. You are not protecting us.
We don't need your protection. We need your respect. Can I just leave it right there?
Yes, you can. I don't need your protection, Donald. I need your respect. And that begins with full citizenship rights, right? I mean,
yeah.
It has really been an incredible week. I want, you know, you to have the opportunity, Dr. Lyerly, to address your voters. You have, I think, really passionately communicated to people why you are pro-choice, why you're running. But there may be a couple of folks out there listening now that haven't heard you tell your story about why you've got a busy medical practice. You got kids, you got a husband, why do you want to be in Congress?
Hey, I have the most amazing life. I have wonderful children. I love my job, but I can't do my job. And I wouldn't say that I'm pro-choice. I would say that I'm pro-patient. Mm. I dream of a time when I can welcome a patient into my office and hear what they have to say, hear what their problem is, talk through all of the options and come up with a solution, and then treat them and continue to follow them afterwards. That relationship, that therapeutic relationship, is so important. You know, medical care isn't like getting your car maintenance. It's not like getting your oil changed. There is a whole thing that goes along with it. You need to know that your doctor, your healthcare provider cares about you. And when your doctor and your healthcare provider knows you, you get better care. So that is my dream. And that is what has propelled me to run for office. My patients not just the women, but the families can't get care. The families. It's a reproductive health issue, but it is a healthcare issue. I work in rural areas. I work in places where people need cars to come and pick them up to get them to their doctor's appointments because they don't have a vehicle. They don't have gas. They can't afford basic medications. There are so many barriers, even if they do have insurance, to being able to get the drugs and the treatments that they need. We've got to make healthcare accessible and affordable for every single American. Ultimately, I want to be part of that solution. That's why I'm doing this.
Yeah, it's in stark contrast to your opponent, who seems to have happened upon a desire to enter public service during his year-long vacation, which is just strange. Did you want to make a comment, Doctor?
Yeah. I mean, as soon as the congressional seat opened up, public service became his number one priority. It had never been a priority for him before. Yeah. And, you know, this is the guy who, when asked on a different civic media station show about his fundraising numbers, because his fundraising is abysmal, he said, well, you know, it's hard for me because I've never had to ask anybody for help before. Well, except for that PPP loan that you took out during COVID and then didn't pay back. That's help. That's over $300,000.
Oh my goodness.
You know, like, be honest with yourself. Be honest with the people around you.
Well, and that's not what we've seen. Like, I don't want somebody in Congress who's never had to ask for help before. That's your job in Congress, to help people.
Yes.
I wanted to ask you a question. I've got Officer DC Metro Police Officer Danny Hodges joining me tomorrow on the show. You have met Danny. He's spoken at one of your rallies. I wanted you to give you the opportunity to address January 6th. And these issues very briefly.
Yeah, well, my opponent held a big rally at a mega church the other night. And during that rally, a January 6th participant said that they were very disappointed with how Mike Gallagher handled the January 6th situation. And they asked if he would do things differently. And he essentially said that the folks who were there, who are imprisoned, they need to be freed. So we this morning issued a joint press release with Danny Hodges, Officer Hodges, and former Officer Harry Dunn, talking about how this is law and order. Yeah. It is applied across the board. Nobody knows this better than you, Maggie. It has to be applied across the board to every single citizen. Nobody gets a free pass here. So just knowing that my opponent feels this way, and that out of one side of his mouth, he says he supports law enforcement, and out of the other side, he wants to release these people who literally killed officers on January 6th. I mean, Danny Hodges was almost crushed. His eyeball was almost gouged by one of the insurrectionists. So, no.
And your opponent wants to pardon the people that did that to Officer Hodges serving the public. Folks, that's Dr. Kristen Lierley, candidate for the 8th Congressional District. Don't go anywhere. I'm so excited. My interview with Sarah Jessica Parker is up next. A feminist and a fearless advocate, both Dr. Lierley and SJP. Bet you thought you'd never hear those together, folks, but you did so here. I'm Maggie Dawn. Keep it locked. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Thank you, Dr. Kristen. Go get them.
Thank you, my friend.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. This lady needs absolutely no introduction, but I'll give her a little bit of one anyways. She's, of course, a star of film, screen, and stage, a fashion icon. She is the incredible Sarah Jessica Parker. Welcome to the Maggie Dawn Show. Thanks so much for making time, SJ.
Oh, thanks, Maggie. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Real thrilled to have you. You know, as we think about both the way that Hollywood and the political arena have framed women for such a long time. women are framed often in relation to men, right? Through a male lens, through the male gaze. And we seem to be returning to a bit of that frame in this election. And so, like you have fought against that frame and to make women and their characters on screen and stage and in film the center of their narratives, themselves, their relationships. I think Kamala Harris is also trying to break through that frame. How is she doing that? Is this inspiring to you? How important is this moment for women, not just in politics, but across all industries as we really try to turn the page?
Oh, that's such a great and smart question. And I'll try to be brief in response. I will say that I'm a parent of two 15-year-old daughters. And as concerned as I've been about this election, and as we can all agree, the stakes are so high, to be witness to my 15-year-old daughters who lamented last night to me, in their words, how disappointed they are that they can't vote, speaks to the sort of inspiration and I think excitement and energy and enthusiasm the vice president has brought in this brief 100 plus days to this election. And I think more importantly, the idea that there is so much at stake for women and that she has harnessed the urgency and the seriousness of what is potentially to be lost has been hugely inspiring, but it's also been motivating. And so as she tries to, and I think has done beautifully, keeping the focus on optimism and hope and opportunity for all people, it's impossible to ignore the role that she can potentially play in all women's lives. And for me, the headline is reproductive freedom. I mean, it's incredibly simple. I don't think it's controversial to say in this country to have lived with access to the healthcare needs of women, to have that be taken away is monumental. And her intention, and she says it time and time again, she's been a fierce champion on the issue of reproductive freedom. I think that this is a moment for women that is not just thrilling, but I think is will shift the plates of the earth in this campaign. And I think we're starting to see it. I'm knocking on my wood floor right now. but I think she's reframing the way the role that women are playing in politics, and I think will be across all industries. We keep talking about her being the first woman and how historical that is. But she's also deeply qualified. And I don't want to forget that and have the historical part eclipse that this is a uniquely qualified person who really wants to be a president for all people. And I think she's articulated it beautifully. And I think last night, Trump did the work for us. He said, "I will protect you women, whether you want it or not." And that to me is a narrative that I personally don't want to live by, and my daughters don't want to live by. And I think we have to return to the freedoms that this, you know, that we've become not only accustomed to, but that are our rights.
Yes, that we deserve full Correct. Participatory equity in all areas of our lives. Let me just close with this question, SJ, and thanks again for making time. You know, you have been a long-term, very vocal supporter of women's empowerment. You've been outspoken, but anytime you engage in this sort of advocacy, there is risk. Why are you so strongly supporting Vice President Harris now? Do you think more people should do the same from other kinds of industries that have a platform similar to yours?
We can go long for a second because this is really important. I'm a citizen. I was raised, I wasn't raised with money. I relate very much to the story that the vice president has been sharing about her life. I believe and know that what she wants is to help people, to help family, to lower costs, to give people the opportunity to have homes, to create a life that allows their children to grow, to have rich existence, to have the possibility to achieve their dreams. And that sounds like the home in which I grew up. That's what my mother wanted for me with very, very little to make it happen. She was industrious and she took full advantage of every opportunity. And that meant we were students in our public schools. That's when public schools were supported. And those are all the things that are incredibly important to the vice president and I think affect all of us. And I just want to say, as a mother, as a woman, you know, the women of Wisconsin have an opportunity to turn the page along with the vice president. You all lived under an abortion ban from the 1800s until about a year ago. Trump and Vance have every intention to create an abortion ban in all 50 states. This is no time to sit on the sidelines. We have to protect each other. We have to protect and speak out for the people who don't feel that they have a voice. And we all have to make a plan to vote. So help neighbors who have a harder time getting there. Talk to your colleagues, your cousins, your friends, your coworkers, your classmates. This election is, in my estimation, the most important in my life. And I am incredibly excited about the role that women will play in it.
Fashion and entertainment icon Sarah Jessica Parker, from her articulate lips to each of your ears, get out and vote. Take your friends, families, and colleagues. Make a plan to vote. It matters. Thank you so much, SJ. Folks, Maggie Dawn. This will do it for this episode of The Maggie Dawn Show. Remember, I'll stand up for you. I hope you stand up for me. But it's always better when we stand together.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.